Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jun Saito of Keio University and Japan Center for Economic Research. As you have just mentioned, I used to be a student in Oxford University and back after 25 years. And some has changed, but some has not changed. And one of the things that has changed is that my relationship within this institute. When I was a student, Professor Stockholm was the director, and I used to come here to read newspapers, not for seminars. And but this time I'm here to do a seminar, and that's quite a difference. It shows that I have gotten old. But anyway, I've been asked to do a seminar here, and I thought about what topics that I would talk about, and instantly, I came up with this topic because Abenomics has a vast influence on whatever is taking place in Japan, and particularly in the economic field. So I'm going to talk about Abenomics, past, present, and future. today's plan is like this. First of all, introduction. I would like to remind ourselves what the Abenomics is all about. I've put one after my Abenomics, means Abenomics Mark 1. And obviously there's a Mark 2. And Abenomics Mark 1 is the one that was introduced in end of late 2012 when Prime Minister Abe came into office. But you might remember that last September, Prime Minister Abe said or announced that the Abenomics has entered the second stage. And so after the second stage, I'll call it Abenomics. But I'll first talk about Abenomics Mark 1. And first, after reminding ourselves of what was Abenomics Mark 1 was, I'm going to talk about why Abenomics was introduced. And then what has Abenomics achieved? And after that, I would like to talk about Abenomics 2, and that's about the future. What should Abenomics address? And I'll end up with some concluding remarks. So first of all, what was Abenomics 1? as I said, Abenomics 1 started in December 2012, and the three arrows. You might know a story about Mori Motonari. This is an ancient warlord in 16th century. He had three sons. He said that he was worried about what would happen after his death, so he told his three sons to cooperate with each other. And he told a story about the three arrows. If you take only one arrow, it's very easy to brook. But if you take three combined, it's very difficult to brook. So that tells you that you should cooperate with each other. And I think Abenomics took that, and that had in mind when they introduced the three arrows. Three arrows are, first, bold monetary policy, second, a flexible fiscal policy, and the third, growth strategy. These are the three arrows, and it was aimed to achieve certain targets. And so I think after reminding ourselves of what the Abenomics was all about, I think we have to think about why it was introduced. Mainly, there were two things. One is about growth. This is real GDP growth rate for the past 60 years. It's a GDP growth rate in annual terms, and it's compared with the previous fiscal year. It tells you a number of things. One is that it fluctuates, and it roughly coincides with the business cycle. But the second thing, and which is most important in this context, is that the growth rate has been declining. In 50s and 60s, that is what we call high growth period, or Koto Seichouki, the average growth rate was about 10%. It's close to what China used to achieve. And we enjoyed about 15 years of high growth. But then the oil crisis came, and it even came twice. And then we had a Plaza Accord, speed appreciation of the yen. And there was something like this. There were a very unstable economic environment surrounding Japanese economy. So the growth rate has come down. And then there was a slight pickup in growth rate in late 1980s because of the bubble economy that was created. But since it was a bubble, it didn't last forever, and it had to burst. And in the 1990s, the growth rate, on average, went down to about 1%. And this is a what we call a lost decade. Some people say that we have lost two decades. But initially, it was called a lost decade, and it only applied for the 10 years, starting from 1991. After the 10 years, there was some improvement, especially in the early phases of the 2000s. In fact, between 2002 and 2007, we experienced the longest expansionary phase after the war. Many people didn't think so. I mean, they didn't feel as though they were in the longest expansionary phase in the post-war history. But in terms of, well, the business cycle, it was, but it was interrupted by the subprime mortgage problem, which erupted in the United States, and especially after the Lehman shock, the growth rate went down quite steeply. In fact, this drop in real GDP was much bigger than the drop of GDP in the United States, even though we were not the origin of the crisis. It recovered, but then it was affected by the Great East Japan earthquake. But the impact of that earthquake was rather temporary, and so we started to resume. But this declining trend of GDP is one of the problems that we face. In fact, if you calculate the potential growth rate at this moment, it's only about 0.5%, only 0.5%. So this is a problem, and if it's all right if it stays that way, but as I will be talking about later, because of the declining population and the aging of the population, this potential growth rate might come further down and even turn negative. So, one thing that Abenomics Mark I tried to address is this decline in growth rate. It was accompanied by deflation. This is a GDP deflator, annual change. There used to be, on average, about 5% increase in GDP deflator. There was a steep, sharp increase after the first oil crisis. But well, that was temporary. We managed quite well in the second oil crisis, so there's no any more jumps here. And it went down. But after mid-1990s, in general, the GDP deflator was in the negative field. And that is one symptom of the deflation, which has been seen. You might see that there's some increase in 2014. Partly that is because of the impact of Abenomics that I'll be talking about. But also, it's a result of the increase in consumption tax rate. So it looks as though it's much better. It looks as though it's much better than it really is. But so deflation is another problem. So Abenomics Mark 1 tried to address this declining trend of a growth rate, or the declining trend of potential growth rate, as well as deflation. Okay, so Abenomics 1, Mark 2 tried to address these problems. And to do so, it introduced three errors. What the Abenomics Mark 1 has achieved. First of all, about the first error, which is about bold monetary policy. First change took place in January 22nd, 2013. The Bank of Japan introduced inflation targeting framework, and it committed itself to achieve 2%. Bank of Japan didn't like this idea, so it resisted for quite a long time. But after Prime Minister Abe came into office, the Bank of Japan changed its attitude. They even started to talk about deflation. Until then, they didn't like the word deflation, because according to them, deflation had many meanings. It brings confusion to the discussion, so they didn't use this word deflation. But after January, they started to use the word deflation, and then they would say that deflation is one of the important problems of the Japanese economy. Interesting to note is that it took place even before Mr. Kroger became the governor of Bank of Japan. It was under the governor Shirakawa that this change took place. But of course, the major change came when the Mr. Kroger became the governor of the Bank of Japan. And immediately after he came into, he took the governorship, the Bank of Japan introduced quantitative and qualitative easing, or QQE, as we call it. It was on April the 4th. It committed to achieve 2%. That's the same as what Bank of Japan said in January. But he also said that it will achieve that in 2 years. So it's a committed, it's a commitment on the inflation rate, and it's a commitment on the time frame. In order to achieve that, they adopted monetary base as its operational target. It used to be the short-term interest rate, but because it had reached zero, they couldn't do it anymore. They shifted the operational target to monetary base, and committed to double its size by the end of 2013. In more concrete terms, it's 273 yen at end 2014. That's why we call this a kind of a unconventional monetary policy. It's unconventional because the emphasis is not on the interest rate, but it's on the size of the balance sheet and the monetary base. In order to double the monetary base, it decided to increase the purchase of long-term government bonds, ETFs, and J-REITs accordingly. and the monetary base policy was implemented in accordance with that, with what has been committed. But nearly after nearly 2 years, just before reaching the 2 year end of the 2 year period, the Bank of Japan expanded the quantitative and qualitative easing. They decided to raise the pace of expansion of the monetary base to 80 trillion yen. Before that, when they said that they would double the monetary base, that means that the monetary base would be increased by 60 to 70 trillion yen each year. But now they said that they will increase it by 80 trillion yen each year. And they decided to purchase more long-term government bonds and ETFs and J-REITs accordingly. The reason why this took place is because there are some unsatisfactory developments that took place in the economy. The Bank of Japan further announced measures to supplement QQE in December 18. This was not a big deal. I mean, there were some changes, but it wasn't something that could be said as an expansion of the QQE. So we were rather disappointed by the announcement in last December. But then came the big surprise last week. But before going on to the surprise, the last which was announced last week, I'll talk about the disappointing developments in the economy. First of all, this is how monetary base has developed. In exchange of a decline in official discount rate and the core rate, the monetary base started to decrease. And that is because, as I said, the interest rate is already low enough. You can't bring it down to negative field, we thought. and so they decided to increase the monetary base. And they did actually increase the monetary base as they have committed. They have reached 273 yen by end 2014, and they further added 83 yen in the following year, so that by the end of last year, the outstanding amount of monetary base is about 350 trillion. That's about 70% of GDP, quite large, even compared to what other central banks have done. But the disappointment is here. This is the consumer price index. As I said, the Bank of Japan committed itself to achieve 2% in 2 years. Now, after the introduction of quantitative or qualitative easing, CPI started to rise. And it wasn't that bad, because by March 2014, the headline CPI, which the Bank of Japan committed, was about 1.5%. So we thought that, well, if this pace goes on, I think it might, it's easy to achieve 2%. But then came the increase in consumption tax rate. This jump is due to the increase in consumption tax rate, because there's nearly 3 percentage point more in terms of the prices, so it reflects in the consumer price index. But if you take out that portion, you will find that the CPI has been declining. And after the temporary impact of the consumption tax rate hike on CPI has vanished, you find that this headline CPI is almost zero. So we are back to the starting point. So I think this is the background of why the expansion of QQE took place, and also that is why the new surprise came last week. I just mentioned and note the issues that were faced by the monetary policy until last week. I touched upon the declining inflation rate. Partly that is because of the falling oil prices on CPI, as well as the weakening of domestic demand due to the increase in consumption tax rate. The headline CPI has diverged from underlying inflation rate, and so they had to do something. I think one of the problems is that their framework was not rightly placed. Headline CPI, that's the CPI that the Bank of Japan committed. But headline CPI includes the impact of oil prices. And so the headline CPI went down as a result of the falling oil prices. But then, but even though that is the situation, they have committed to achieve 2% within 2 years. They can't control headline CPI because of this decline in oil prices. So from my point of view, what they should have done is commit themselves on core CPI, excluding the impact of oil prices, which is not controllable by the Bank of Japan, and which is more close to the underlying inflation rate, and say that it will reach 2%, achieve 2% in 2 years. Or otherwise, if they want to stick to headline CPI, they shouldn't commit themselves in the time span. They should say that they will achieve 2% in the medium term. So I think there was a bit of a problem of their commitment. But anyway, that's the situation. And now the Bank of Japan expects that the 2% will be achieved in early fiscal year 2017. Now, this is another problem because of the second point that I'm going to talk about. There's a limited room for further Japanese government bonds to purchase. As I said, the Bank of Japan has committed itself to purchase 80 trillion yen a year. But now, the government only issues only 40 trillion yen per year. So that means that the Bank of Japan has to purchase a government bond from the portfolios that already exist, and which is held by commercial banks, insurance companies, and other agents. To some extent, I think that is possible. But you know, commercial banks need government bonds because they have to use this as a collateral. And the insurance companies, they need it to match the liability side. So they want some long-term government bonds. So there's a limit to that. And there's a lot of estimates done by institutions like IMF and the Japan Center for Economic Research. And they say that the limit will be faced in 2017 or 2018 at the latest. So that means that it's very close to the timing of the achieving 2%. If that is going to be postponed, then they'll face what they would be able to do in terms of purchasing some bonds. I think that's one of the reasons why they have come up with this surprise. But before touching upon that, there's also some increasing uncertainty surrounding the economy. Slowdown of the world economy, including China, sharp decline in stock prices, which has taken place in the Tokyo stock market, and the appreciation of the yen is still seen as a kind of safe haven. And the appreciation of the yen took place. So the private sector forecasters has revised down the GDP and the CPI. So all this was a background to the new announcement that took place last week. Bank of Japan called it a QQE with a negative interest rate. They introduced a three-tier system to the current account at the Bank of Japan. The current account at the Bank of Japan is held by banks. Until now, when the banks has a current account at the BOJ, the required reserves portion, which is reserves that is necessary when you have a certain amount of deposits, okay? And that's they're required to hold current reserves in accordance with the amount, magnitude of the deposits. And that incurs zero interest rate. But whatever the excess reserves that they would have was given 0.1% interest rate. So just by having a current account balance at the Bank of Japan, the banks, commercial banks, were able to get interest from the Japan. But that means that the commercial banks would be comfortable just having the deposits in the Bank of Japan and not lending to the private sector. And we hope that the private sector would do more investment with the lending, and it's a multiplier effect. So so I think the Bank of Japan wanted to change that. And so the three-tier system introduced, that means that the required reserves will still have zero interest rate. The excess reserve, which existed until February 16th, that is given 0.1% positive interest rate. But whatever excess reserves, which is going to be added to what is already now, is would be given a negative interest rate. That means that the banks, the commercial banks, has to pay interest rate to the Bank of Japan. And obviously, you know, that should be a disincentive for the commercial banks to have a current balance in the Bank of Japan. But that is exactly what the Bank of Japan aimed for. By doing, to introducing this kind of a scheme, the Bank of Japan considered that the commercial banks would be more eager to lend to companies. Okay, so that was a surprise, and I think I can see that why they had to do that, because of the three the points that I mentioned earlier. So that's the monetary policy. So the second error is the fiscal, flexible fiscal policy. Fiscal policy has two dimensions. One is a stimulative dimension. I mean, the fiscal policy aimed to stimulate the economy. The other dimension is the fiscal consolidation side. First, on the first dimension, public works program has been increased. Additional appropriation was made by the supplementary budget for fiscal year 2012, which was introduced soon after Mr. Abe came into office, and that added to the public works program, and public works program is a part of the public investment. So that should stimulate the economy. Also, there's been a declining trend of initial budget appropriation of construction public works program, but it was reversed from fiscal year 2013. So they have started to, not spectacularly, but they have started to grow. Well, at least they stayed flat, not declining. So maybe I'll show you the next chart. This is the contribution of public demand on GDP. And please look at the red part. It shows that after the first quarter of 2013, the red part is making a positive and relatively big contribution to real GDP. That means that the public investment was a contributing factor to the real GDP. It's not. It hasn't been always there, but that is understandable. But because once the monetary policy starts to work, they would be able to expect a stimulus coming from the monetary policy. So when the flexible fiscal policy idea was introduced, they would say that the monetary policy might take time to show its effect. So meanwhile, the fiscal policy is going to do the work. So I think from that point of view, they did do the work. But now, going back to the fiscal consolidation. As we know, consumption tax rate was raised from 5% to 8% in April 2014. It's the first increase in tax rate since 1997. It was, at that time, it was raised from 3 to 5. But then it was raised from 5 to 8. And it was coupled with another consumption tax rate hike, which was supposed to take place in October 2015. But because the government was not sure that the economy was would endure a kind of a negative impact coming from the consumption tax rate hike, they postponed it to April 2017. So it's going to take place April next year. And the most recent development is that when the consumption tax is going to, tax rate is going to raise to be raised to 10%, they will introduce the two-tier tax rate system. So the tax rate on foods and beverages, well, a kind of a necessity, will be applied 8%, and others will be raised to 10%. We were able to avoid this kind of a complication to the tax rate system until now, but the decision has been taken place, probably because of the political need in order to persuade the Komei Party, which is the coalition partner of the Liberal Democratic Party, to support the idea of raising the consumption tax rate and others. But this is the situation. But, well, stimulating the economy by fiscal policy is all right if you just look at the contribution of the GDP. But it has its negative side, and this is the negative side. The central government bonds has been increasing continuously. Interesting to know, even though we have quite a huge central government bonds, which is now equivalent to about 160% of GDP, if you add to that the stock of local government bonds and borrowing by the government, it will reach nearly 200%. But the interesting thing to note is that this issue started from 1965. Until 20 years after the war, there were no issuance of government bonds. But when in 1965, interesting enough, it's right after the first Olympic Games in Tokyo, there was a recession, and it was a serious recession from the period at that time. They started to issue government bonds. First, it was only construction bonds, and construction bonds was allowed by the fiscal law, which was in place. What was not allowed is the deficit financing bonds, but that even started to be issued in 1975, right after the first oil crisis. But since that is against the law, the government has needs to introduce a special legislation each year in order to be able to issue deficit financing bonds. Sometimes, you know, if the ruling coalition does not have a power in both houses, they get into trouble because the opposition would say that we will not pass this legislation, and that causes a lot of problems. But that is the situation. So anyway, the fiscal situation is very bad. I'm sorry if there is any Greeks here, but it's even worse than Greeks. Now, in order to consolidate the fiscal situation, we have three-point strategy to deal with the fiscal consolidation. One is to halve the deficit in the primary account of the central and local government combined that exists in fiscal year 2010 by fiscal year 2015. So halving the primary deficit by 2015. Second is to achieve surplus in the primary account of the central and local government combined by fiscal year 2020. Achieve primary surplus. And then the third is to stably reduce the ratio of government debt to GDP after fiscal year 2010. So that's the three the targets that the government has set itself. There's an intermediate target here, which was introduced last year, that before fiscal year 2020, there will be an intermediate target introduced. And it will be a primary deficit of 1%. We need to check whether that is achieved in fiscal year 2018. So that's kind of an intermediate target. But basically, these are the three targets that the government would like to achieve. Now, in order to check whether they are on track, the government produces a projection twice every year, in summer and in winter. And this is a projection about primary balance. Okay. Now, the projection is for two scenarios. One is the baseline scenario, and the other is economic revitalization scenario. Baseline scenario is on the assumption that nothing additional will take place in terms of policies. So business as usual kind of scenario. And then economic revitalization case is when the economy shows a higher growth rate. But in real GDP terms, about 2%, and in the nominal GDP terms, it's about 3%. The baseline scenario is about a real growth rate of 1% and 1.5% in terms of nominal terms. So there's a difference in the nominal growth rate. But it shows that, well, of course, if you have a higher growth rate, the primary balance is going to improve. But the problem is that even though the first target will be achieved, that's halving the primary deficit by 2015, that will be achieved. But the problem is that even this is a government projection, it shows that in 2020, this will still be in the deficit. The government target is to achieve surplus in the primary account. But the projection, their projection, shows that there is still stay in the deficit. And it includes the impact of consumption tax rate hike to 10%. Okay. So 10% is not enough. So what should be done? Either we raise consumption tax rate further, or we have to cut in expenditure. Well, probably have to do both. This is the debt to GDP ratio, again for the two scenarios. And it shows that in the baseline scenarios with low growth rate, the debt to GDP ratio is going to rise further. So it's going to explode. But for the economic revitalization case, it shows that it is going down. And you might think that, well, that means that the third target is going to be achieved. But please be careful, because I think this is going to be a temporary thing. Because those of you who have studied economics is a Doma condition. And if the nominal interest rate is higher than nominal growth rate, the debt to GDP ratio would not stabilize. It would go up. And that is exactly the case. I mean, the government's projection shows other indicators, including long-term interest rate and nominal GDP. But if you compare the two, interest rate is going to be higher than nominal GDP. So eventually, this should go up. For the time being, it goes down because the government bonds, which incur only low interest rate because they were issued in the past when the interest rate was very low. So it takes time for the high interest rate, the current high interest rate, is going to affect the stock of government bonds. So it's a kind of temporary thing. So taken together, I think we still have a lot to do in terms of fiscal consolidation. But it's not an easy thing to do, because the problem is, well, raising tax rate is a difficult thing. But and but reducing the government expenditure is another very difficult thing. And it's especially difficult because we have to cut the social security expenditure. We have to cut the private public investment and other discretionary expenditure. But this is an obligatory expenditure. It's there's a legislation behind it, and we, you know, the government or the Ministry of Finance cannot do whatever they would like to. So that's the problem, and also because the aging is taking place, it's a natural tendency for the social security expenditure to blow up. But this is a projection made by Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. And it shows what would happen in the medium term to pension, healthcare, and long term, and others. You might be surprised, not quite sure, but the pension is not a problem because we have already a mechanism called macroeconomic slide. This is a mechanism which automatically cuts the pension benefits when there's a longevity, the further extension of longevity, and also when there's a shrinkage of people who pay premiums for the social security. And so that, if that is in place, and in fact, it was enacted in 2004, and it didn't, it wasn't activated because of the deflation. But because we are somewhat close to overcoming deflation, it was introduced last year in fiscal year 2015, and it automatically cut the pension benefits by 0.9%. So if that is continues to bite, I think the pension is under control somewhat. But the problem is healthcare and long-term care. There's no such mechanism for those, and if aging takes place, it will naturally raise the expenditure. So this is what we have to tackle, and this is a very difficult issue. Now about the third arrow, growth strategy. A document called Japan Revitalization Strategy was announced in June 2013. This describes all the measures that would be necessary in order to introduce growth strategy. In fact, it's like a telephone directory, and it's a very thick book, and you have everything in it. And, those measures that are included include stimulating business startups, increasing labor participation rate of females, expanding market for healthcare, pharmaceutical medical equipment, and increasing FTAs, participating in negotiations for TFP, doubling inward from back investment, and introducing national strategic special zones. There are others, many others, but just looking at these, they're all important, I think. But if you think of it, first arrow was monetary policy, second arrow fiscal policy, and the third arrow should naturally be structural policy. But it doesn't say so. It's a growth strategy. So it includes not only structural policy, but also demand side policy. And I think, from my point of view, I think it should be more focused on structural. But that is what the government has announced. And there are progresses made. Recent initiatives include designation of 9 areas of national strategic special zones. What it means that is that there will be a limited deregulation taking place in those special zones. And if it's successful, there's a possibility that it will be extended to other regions. So it's a kind of experiment. But that is important when we try to introduce deregulation. An introduction of the Corporate Governance Code in June 2015 was very well appreciated by OECD. Conclusion of the TPP and successive reduction of effective corporate tax rate, it will be below 30% from next April. And liberalization of the electricity retail market from this April, and liberalization of gas market from April 2017. So first time from April, we'll be able to choose from which company we're going to purchase electricity. There's a lot of the proposals made by the companies. Railroading companies are selling with electricity. Of course, the gas companies are selling electricity. Mobile phone companies are selling electricity. So a lot of competition. So these are the things that has taken place. But I said that we should be more focused on structural policy. And from my point of view, they should address the core structural problem. And the core structural problem is the Japanese economic system. The current system was introduced or established in high growth period of 50s to 70s. That includes a system which includes lifetime employment system, seniority-based wage system, and in-house training of employees. On the financial side, it's bank lending as main source of corporate finance. And in terms of corporate governance system, the shareholders' influence was not that big, it was limited. And so the main banks, the banks provided the governance. These worked well in the 50s and 70s. And Japan, as number one, a book like that was published. But there came the problem. And I think that is because the underlying conditions has changed quite a bit, especially since 1990. Aging and declining of population. Seniority-based wage system, for instance, is easy if you have more and more young people coming in, which is paid low. So they can compensate for the high wages for the aged workers. But now, there's a smaller number of young people and a bigger portion of aged people. So the seniority-based wage system cannot continue. So that's one important factor. The second important factor is the strong competitive pressure from globalization. There was competition during the high growth period, but the competition with domestic companies doing the same business. We still have many automobile companies, but there are a lot of domestic competition. And in terms of overseas competition, there was a competition with the companies in the developed economy, like Europe or the United States. And there we can compete by quality rather than prices. But now we have to compete with developing economies and emerging economies, and we have to compete in prices. And that is going to be a difficult. And thirdly, need of product innovation in new industries. In high growth period, we are able to import technologies from overseas, and we can do process innovation. So making the same good, but in a more rationalized way, or streamlined way, which is cheaper. So, but that is what has taken place. But now you have to do the product innovation because you are at the front line of technology development. And especially you have to do product innovation in new industries like IT or biotechnology and all that. But these is some these are the areas where startups are very important, but we have very low rates of startups. So because of these factors, the problem has started to emerge in the economic system. It needs to be reformed in order to match the underlying conditions, but still it hasn't been done. So there's going to cause a lot of problems. I'll just mention two of the problems. One is, it should be familiar by now, but there's an increasing portion of non-regular workers. Regular workers means workers who are under lifetime employment. There's more part-time workers, more fixed-term workers, and dispatched workers and all that. So, and they are paid much lower wage than regular workers. And the portion is increasing. And that is behind the recent discussions about inequality, or the kakusakumei in Japanese. But this is going to be a problem for the society. And this is about the startups. I've taken this from the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor, but it shows that the entrepreneurial activity rate is very low. There's a similar statistic published by the OECD, but it shows that Japan is the lowest in terms of startups and also closure rate or exit rate among the OECD countries. So these are the problems that has already emerged. The reason why this is so is because if you have a lifetime employment system, it's very risky for a graduate to engage in entrepreneurship, because if you fail, you cannot go back to the mainstream. So if you don't want to take risk, you stay with others, and you want to go into you want to be employed by a large company and enjoy lifetime employment. Also, in terms of financial sector, means that there's not much risk capital in the system. The saver is a household, but the financial asset held by a household is the majority of them is bank deposits. The money goes to banks. Now, banks doesn't lend, not so much. And what they purchase is government bonds. So the banks are now intermediary between household and the government, not intermediary between the household and the company. So there's a problem with the financial assistance of startups. let me see. Okay, so that's the three arrows of the Abenomics Mark I. Now, about Abenomics Mark II. This is to remind ourselves what the Abenomics Mark II was. It was announced last September when Mr. Abe was re-elected as a leader of the New Democratic Party. He said that Abenomics is entering a second stage, and he introduced a new set of three arrows. It's mentioned here. But I'm not going to go into the details, because for me, they're all important, but what I would like to emphasize is this. Mr. Abe, when he introduced the three arrows, they said that the government is committed to maintain a population of 100 million in 50 years' time, and would create a lively society where the 100 million can be very active. Now, the government has committed itself to a 100 million population. That is very important from my point of view. Because if you think about medium to long term, the population is going to be a big drag on the economy. This is a projection done by the National Institute of Population. You might have seen this many times. But now we have a population about 127, 128 million. In 50 years' time, it's going to shrink to two-thirds of what we have. In 100 years' time, it's going to shrink to one-third of what we have. So 40 million in 100 years' time. That is going to a lot of problems to the society, but in terms of economics, it's also very important, because if you do a simple calculation, it's going to be a decline in population by 1.1% annually. Okay. If you think about the growth accounting framework, you apply the labor share GDP. That gives you the negative impact coming from the declining population of the magnitude of 1.7% every year. So this is going to be a drag on the potential growth rate of 0.7 every year. This is the current potential growth rate, this blue line. And it fluctuates, but currently it's about 0.5%, as I said earlier on. It's about 0.5%. And it's already because of the negative impact coming from labor imports. So 0.7 that I mentioned just now is not an additional element. It's already here. But this is going to continue to exert a negative influence on growth rate. And eventually, it would have an impact on the savings, if you think about the life cycle hypothesis. And it might also influence the TFP part. So I think this population decline is a very big problem from the point of view of a Japanese economy. So we need to offset that negative impact coming from the population decline. I can think of four potential measures, and I'm going to mention one by one. First of all, raising participation rate, especially of women. This is a big problem. This is what we call M-shaped curve. The participation of female workers falls in the age of 30s and 40s because it's very difficult to keep a job while having a family or having children. After the children has become big enough, they will go back to the labor market. But usually, it's non-regular workers. Okay, this is the usual chart here. But you can also get participation rate according to the marital status. And the problem is, if you are unmarried, you keep a high participation rate because there's no problem, a conflict between work and family because she's single. But if you're married, you have very low the participation. So that is, of course, if you get married, you shift over here. So this is the one symptom of the problem. Now, this is urgent measure that we should achieve. But my argument is that what is going to happen after it has increased to the maximum? What would happen if the participation rate of female workers would reach the level of Nordic countries, for instance? There would be no further offsetting factor coming from this. Because raising participation means more labor force. So that means that you would have less negative influence coming from the current population. But what I'm saying is that there's a limit to what you can do. So the second thing is innovation, naturally. Raising productivity, okay? The TFP part should be a major offsetting factor. And that's a very popular, and naturally, I think it's a very important. But from my point of view, I cannot be so optimistic, because if you think about the supply side of innovation, you need scientists and engineers. And as this shows, if you have a declining population, you would have less number of scientists and less number of engineers. And it already is flattening. The number of scientists and engineers in Japan is already flattening. In 1960, I think, Kuznets, a very famous economist, said that population growth is not a problem. There were, traditional view that the population growth means a negative thing to growth. But what he said is that growth of population is positive for the economy because you have more people with talents. My argument is the other way around. If you have a less number of population, you have less scientists and engineers, and that should affect, in the long term, the magnitude of innovation. Now, the third thing is raising productivity, fertility rate. That's natural. We used to have a very high fertility rate. It used to be 4.5 right after the war, but it has come down. And it started to become lower than 2.1, which is the fertility rate we need to reproduce the population. And it is, that took place in 1974. Then it went down until 2005, reached the level 1.26. It has recovered somewhat, and in the latest number is 2014 is 1.42. But it's still way down below the 2.1, which we need to stabilize the population. But interesting thing is that if you take the fertility rate of a married couple, it's about 2%, 2. So, what's the problem? The problem is that young people are not getting married. That is important because this is a strange chart. It's like a waterfall. But this is a portion of a legitimate child and illegitimate child. That means that the children born from a formerly married couple or not. And the special feature of Japan compared to maybe Europe and other countries is that most of the babies are born among the formerly wedded couple, more than 97%. Okay? So the problem is whether you get married or not. And this is the share of unmarried by age groups. The share is increasing. And it's not only increasing. So there's a postponement of marriage, but there are some people decide to not get married. It's very difficult to get a statistic, but this is the average of the age 45 to 54. Not married. This is an approximation of those who would not choose to get married, 20% of male, 10% of female. So the problem is that we have to persuade people to get married. And that is a very difficult thing. Now, my argument is if we are able to achieve 2.1% from next year. That's a different thing, to achieve, but assume that we were able to do that, 2.1, achieve 2.1 next year. What would happen to the population? I'm sorry, this is in Japanese, but maybe we would understand Japanese. But this is a projection of what would happen to the population if the fertility rate reaches 2.1. And this solid line is for the current projection. Even though the fertility rate reaches 2.1, it will not immediately stabilize the population because you have less number of mothers. So even though they have larger number of children, it would not affect the population in general. And it takes about 60 to 70 years before the population stabilizes. So what can we do? I've talked about three measures, and they all seem to be difficult. And maybe some of you might be able to guess, but the only solution I can think of is immigration. Japan has the smallest number among at least these countries. It's only 1.4% of the labor force is immigrant. It's much lower than Singapore, but I think we are asking too much to become like Singapore. UK, US, France has a much lower, higher rate. Even Korea has a higher rate. And Korea has started to invite more foreign workers. And I think this might be, well, I can't think of anything else, but in the medium term, before the fertility rate would bite on the population, this is the measure. But this is a very unpopular measure, policy in Japan. If you ask an American what do you think about immigration, they'll say, well, why not? That's very important. That's very natural. If you ask a European about this, they'll be more cautious. I think there's a split of religions. But I'm speaking in terms of economics and what we have to do in terms of maintaining the potential growth rate. I can't think of anything else. Of course, there are arguments that the macro GDP growth is not a problem. It's important that to see the per capita GDP to grow. It's not the whole the macro GDP. Because we would classify developing economies according to the per capita GDP because we think it's important. But in our case, we have a problem in the fiscal situation. We have a problem in the social security. And in order to be able to sustain those systems, we need a growth in macro terms. So that's why I've argued this way. So I think I have talked much. Some concluding remarks. Policy setting towards the targets of getting out of deflation and resuming growth has improved considerably. That's undeniable. But macroeconomic policies have made progress. But however, there are still much to be done before the targets are achieved. Policy has also made some progress, as I listed, but the core problem is yet to be identified and tackled. And the most crucial and difficult task is to stop the population from shrinking. But tackling the problem may inevitably lead to a drastic change of the traditional Japanese society. And that is the challenge that we face. So thank you very much for listening.